Blog Talk Radio.
And of course, that is the one and only Pancho Sanchez doing the Watermelon Man, doing it live. That's a live performance. Once again, this is the K Thompson Live Show. I am the son. My name is Eric Payne. And you are?
I am the mother. I am K Thompson.
There it is, in the flesh. She's here in the flesh, K Thompson, on the K Thompson Live Show. Today is May. I don't know the exact date. I would believe it's probably around the 13th of May, 2015. And so what's been going on? You have some things you want to talk about, Mike, you want to talk about who we're going to be talking to today, possibly.
Yeah, we're going to be talking to Sheila Oliver, who is one of the most powerful African-American women in the state assembly. And she was a speaker of emeritus. And we're going to be asking her about some of the issues, you know, that she is dealing with and some of the problems of the community and what's going on in the state legislature. And also, you know, we're going to find out what's happening down there with New York waterfront. So we're going to be talking to her about that. And also, even before we do that, we get to anyone, you know, we're going to be talking to Wayne Gilman. He'll be calling in soon.
I think that Wayne might be. Is this Mr. Wayne? Is that you, Mr. Wayne?
Yes. Good evening, everyone. How's everybody?
How are you?
I guess okay. Trying to make it through another day, a busy day. You know, what could I tell you? And it just seems like life never seems to change. Every day there's something new. I'm really highly upset about this Amtrak accident, you know?
I know. It's awful. Yeah.
It really is.
And they're trying to get to the bottom of it, and it looks like they're going to be charging someone with, you know, not paying attention or whatever, I don't know, because that train was going extra fast around this curve, and so a lot of people lost their lives, and that's been one of the top stories today, so that's really unfortunate, and we hate to even start a show like that, but that's life. And that's
I know. So
what's going on over there in the Big Apple?
Well, we've gone through so many different stories in the last week or so since the last time we were on. It seems like our mayor's poll numbers, de Blasio, apparently is dropping, merely because a lot of it stems from the fact that a lot of New Yorkers, and I'm not saying the people who supported him, but primarily those people outside of the core support community, see him as trying to move from local politics into the national arena. He actually was before Congress today about, you know, the infrastructure with respect to transportation issues. Can't believe Congress cut funding again for Amtrak, given what happened, last night, you know?
Yeah.
So there's been issues about that. And then at one point it seemed like he didn't want to increase the number of people in the police force, but because of the spate of violence and the protest and the recent killing of the police officer in Queens a week ago, now there's talk in his camp that he's looking to bolster the ranks. And so there's that issue. And, you know, it goes on and on. I mean, it just seems like a lot of the things that we experienced, you know, 30 years ago are in a recycling phase again, and that's it. We found out that a number of the medical institutions in the borough of Brooklyn are not places that if you're seriously ill you want to go to, because basically there have been so many instances in which malpractice allegedly has been performed, And the Post, New York Post, which is not a paper of record in my opinion, but the deal is they've cited like Brookdale Hospital, which is in the heart of the black Latino community in East New York, Brooklyn, even Kings County, Brooklyn Hospital, places like that. You know, some of the major places where, God forbid, if there's an emergency, a lot of us report to are not places that you'd want to be in, unfortunately.
You know, that's some scary stuff.
It is scary.
You know, I mean, come on.
It is scary. You know, because you'd like to think you're going to get the best care in these facilities, regardless of what goes on. And and I'm just surprised with the amount of changes that have gone on in Brooklyn that, you know, you would think that the best of care probably has shifted from Manhattan to places like that. But if you're not, it's according to the article and a study that they conducted, if you're not in NYU, Columbia Presbyterian, or Mount Sinai, forget about it.
Wow.
Yeah, I wouldn't.
That's bad.
I mean, to me, to be quite honest, I wouldn't want to have to go in the hospital in the city, merely because what concerns me and what one thing that always kind of piqued my curiosity was when you're in the Manhattan traffic and you see a siren coming down the street, you hear it coming down the street, and all the traffic is there, like nowhere to go, and I'm like, wow, I hope that person is not in urgent need of care.
Right.
Because, and some people just don't seem to be getting out the way either, which is the crazier thing. And in Manhattan, you know, it's because there's so congested. I've been in traffic, was so congested, there was literally seeming no place for people to pull over to the side. So, and New York is such a big city, so dense, is that everything is about, let's keep, and this is me talking, everything is about, let's keep things moving. Let's keep, you know, let's don't stop the show, you know. If you're in line or something, you don't want to stop the show because we got to keep moving. We got too many people, you know. You know, when you get on the subway and one subway turnstile is having trouble, you know, people, it's so many people. You got to keep the assembly line moving. So I think, you know, in those situations, quality suffers, certainly, because you have no, like, who's the supervisor here? Let's stop the presses and bring attention to this matter, and which sometimes a lot of these matters may seem really small, but they eventually, if they're not taken care of, they spiral out and become bigger problems, and it affects a larger portion of the population. But not until something like that, not until something like that happens, does that normally happen. To me, it seems like if you're one or two people and you happen to be not as well, you know, wealthy or connected or things like that, then you can fall through the cracks. I really think that it's like that in any society, but certainly the larger that the services are provided to the masses, where you don't have an opportunity to stand out, to get that individual treatment that every sick person should at least be able to receive for a few minutes when they see a medical professional, seems to be lost in New York.
Yeah, and you know what? There's so many people in New York, and there's so many different languages, you know, different cultures and whatnot. I often wonder about that, you know, with the New York hospitals, because when we were on WLRB a long time ago, not that long ago, but we were always so concerned when there was something that happened in the community and if people were going to get, you know, immediate medical care or not. And a lot of times, you know, these things happen that they just didn't get the care, and we had another story, and I'm talking about a lot of the shootings. And talk about shootings, let's talk a little bit about the demonstrations. You know, they're still going on, and we still are hearing more and more, you know, having more and more information about police persons shooting African-American people. So say it again?
No, I was saying no question about that. I mean, you know, both issues are almost hand in hand. They're paramount because on one sense, I mean, God forbid if you fall victim to something, like the young brother in Baltimore who lost his life at the hands of what seems to be the local police department. You know, the fact of the matter is that you want to make sure that at least you're being taken someplace where you're going to get adequate care, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as, you know, the behavior modification that a lot of these departments have to go through, at least in New York and other large municipalities, I think they're beginning to start the training all over again. They're rethinking things. you have these body cameras, you know, that basically complement the cameras that are in the squad cars and things like that. But the bottom line is that, you know, that is not national. And you still have instances where there's abuse. But the whole medical thing, you know, you're absolutely right, Kay. There are 8 million people in New York. There are well over 150 different languages that are spoken here. And the deal is that, you know, I agree with Eric. I've sat in traffic. I've sat through demonstrations where they'll shut the West Side Highway down, and God forbid there is an ambulance somewhere, you know. In one sense, you're trying to get somebody's attention through peacefully demonstrating, but,
yeah,
you know, you're also risking someone else's life in the process.
Right.
And that's it. And, you know, I say 8 million and 46,000 cops, there's something wrong here.
Yeah. Well, fortunately, New Jersey is not that congested yet. You know, so I don't think it's that bad here in New Jersey, but it's something to be very concerned about. You know, I want to mention something go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that New Jersey slowly become the repository for all of New York's gains. You know, when people cannot afford to live here anymore, guess where they're going? You know, I mean, it's just one of those things. I've seen people who go there and they don't come back, and I understand it. I understand it.
No, I've been seeing. I wanted to ask what you thought of your opinion about these commercials I've been seeing on TV that are talking about, you know, the average person who works in New York can't afford to live in New York. Is that in reference to a living wage that they're trying to push in the New York Assembly or something like that? Are they trying to pass a living wage bill to have people make, you know, a decent rate or a decent hourly wage?
No, I agree. That's part of the problem. I mean, you have a lot of people out here who are basically, are not in a position to hold an apartment. The level of homelessness in the city has skyrocketed beyond proportions. A lot of the shelters are overwhelmed. And the deal is that you have these fat cat landlords, not someone little like me, who get all sorts of entitlements and abatements and this, that, and the other, you know, just to build. And this is basically a spillover from what Bloomberg's vision of what New York has been about or was about back then. And he's put things, vehicles into motion where, you know, it's really become so costly to stay here, and even though there may be jobs out here, they're not paying anything commensurate with what people charge for rent. And I'm sorry, I mean there are times when I even look at some of the things that I do. I tell people, I say, hey, you know, not that I want to be constantly looking for, you know, someone to fill my space, but at the end of the day, I encourage anyone to go out and get their own, because the bottom line is that unless you're in a position where you can comfortably afford something, it's tragic what they put people through, you know? And I also think that it affects the school systems and everything else that's involved.
Yeah.
These big fat cat landlords should be paying for half the stuff that, you know, that we're losing, our infrastructure, too. They should be paying, doubling up for mass transit, education, all these things, you know, health care.
Wayne, are you one of those fat cat landlords? Are you one of those fat cats?
Well, I'll tell you, I was once motivated by that, but, you know, it's as a professional now and someone who basically is at a point where they're sick and tired of having to deal with the whole process, it's just one of those things. I mean, I enjoy doing what I'm doing, and it started out, I think it's just something that started out as a child. I watched my dad do it, and, you know, he was somewhat successful during his period. I mean, if he were alive today, he'd be far more successful if he had the skills and the opportunities. But it's also been a not an easy process for many of us, because there was a problem of redlining at one time, and and you couldn't go into depressed areas and try to make money. Then you got rent control, which is a double-edged sword, you know, and it's just one of those things. I mean, it's New York is not easy. Let's put it that way.
You say all that
it's
to say that this is not easy. Okay, I understand that. Well, let's talk a little bit about Jersey. I want to talk a little bit about Jersey, what we did last week. I went to see down in Jersey Tech, as a matter of fact, which has become the, you know, performing arts center, you know, to go to.
Right.
You know, New Jersey. And the Alvin Ailey Company was down there. And I have seen Alvin Ailey's concerts for years, for so many years, as a matter of fact. You know, I was one of those people who actually, when we had our dance studio, stole his choreography and stole Revelations, you know.
You were inspired by
it. I was inspired by and stole it. Definitely Revelations. So, and I hadn't seen it in a couple of years, so I went down and really very enjoyable. Packed as usual. Liked
wow.
it, enjoyed it, and so forth and so on. Also, a good friend of mine who used to be in the Thompson Dance Studio was performing today down at, what was it, City Hall, Eric and Sons, where they have a concert down there by the Lincoln statue down there, Cynthia Holliday. And she has become a fantastic international jazz singer. And so she's also going to be and she's also going to be performing at the place that you have yet to go to, Duke's Seven Table Restaurant, which is owned by Vonda McDowell, which is probably one of the newest dance clubs downtown Newark. Downtown Newark is really, you know, expanding, and it's beginning to look a little bit in about some part, like some part of downtown Manhattan. So there's a lot of activity going on. We are waiting to hear from the speaker, former Assembly Speaker Emeritus Sheila Oliver. She's supposed to be calling in, but if not, we can always continue with what we're doing. Also, what about those demonstrations? You know, we haven't really heard that they're continuing, but I understand that they are going to be continuing in various states.
They are continuing. It's just it seems to be well organized these times that, you know, you don't see the level of arrest that were, you know, in play before, from
that's
what I
true.
See.
Excuse me. Or either they're just not letting that get on the press or get through the press. You know, because you get tired of it. And it's not that the demonstrators don't have reasons now, okay? So I don't agree with the kind of demonstrations that's going on, but I do agree that demonstrations do have to happen when you have police brutality, okay?
Oh, no question,
And we have to be up on the Freddie Gray case. I think that's probably still going on. A whole lot of other things are moving around downtown. Also, I want to mention, too, I didn't mention that Cynthia Holliday, Jazz Blues, she's going to be downtown at Duke's on the 30th of May. I wanted to say that. We also have that on our, my Facebook, so people can go and see that. Also, when I interviewed Rosa Parks, we went down to the City Hall of the Hortus Records, House of Records. What's the name of that big building down there, Eric?
Hall of Records.
And I took a picture sitting the statue of Rosa Parks. And because, in fact, when I interviewed her, you know, we were sitting and we were talking. So I have that picture, so that's up on my face so people can see that. I did that interview with her in 1989. So that was when I was over at WIB. Okay.
And she looks so lifelike, that statue. I mean, I was really impressed by the picture when you sent it to me, you know. And beautiful shot. Beautiful shot, you know. I'd like to see that place, you know. You say it's in Newark?
You come to Jersey more often.
Okay.
Like Reverend Al did. He came over here to a church in Newark. In fact, I saw him. We talked.
What was that? You want to talk about that? You saw Reverend Al. When was
Reverend Al? That was Sunday. Was it last Sunday or the Sunday before that? He came down to, I forget his name, the Reverend Ron.
Reverend Ron Christian Church.
Yeah, I was very impressed with the church.
Reverend Al, what was the event? Reverend Al was the guest speaker. Tell us about it a little bit.
He was the speaker. Can you wait? He was the speaker down there. And he had everybody waiting because of the fact that he was also had his radio show to do. And he was doing the radio, and then he finally came out, which was okay because people were waiting. Although the choir was singing over and over and over again. But I do have to say that the music was good. The choir is fantastic there. You know, and I haven't been to church in when my brother passed and my sister passed. You know, I had to go to church then, but I haven't been in a long time. So I really, really did enjoy that. So enjoy the fact that that church exists. And another thing I was into, I was not really shocked. I was surprised at the way people dress. People just come in however they're dressed.
Right.
And I love that because it's like, at least the church is open. If someone doesn't have nice clothes to wear or what you consider the nice clothes, you know, a lot of people would stay away from church. So this way, that church is so open and so comfortable and such a wonderful atmosphere, you know, that you can come in jeans or sneakers or whatever. But the point is, as long as you're there and as long as you're, you know, getting what you're getting out of a church situation. So,
yeah, I think that that whole kind of get dressed up and wear your finest, you know, the concept is to, when you come before the Lord, you should be able to wear your finest, because if you go out Saturday night, and Saturday night deserves your finest, then the Lord deserves your finest as well. But I think what that has done, in my opinion, over years, and I've felt like that myself, is that people who can't afford to look a certain way probably neglected going to church a lot of times because they couldn't afford the dress-up that some places place value on, unfortunately. And it seems that over the years, our society has gotten a little bit more accepting and a little bit more relaxed in those type of values. Just a lot in general, we're a lot more of an informal society in terms of the way we dress. Maybe it's gone a little bit too far in some situations, but certainly in the house of the Lord, that everybody should be welcome to be able to come in. And Ron Christian is known for being a person the average person can relate to on the street. He's gone through trials and tribulations at a lot of my age, and he's a little bit younger than I am, but he's in my age group, I would suppose to say. But he's someone that connects with the people and connects with a lot of the young people. And over the years, clearly, since I've been away, I've been hearing about him. And I knew him before when he was going through his challenges in life. And just to see him where he is and being a person who can inspire and help people, help them to come through what they need to come through is really inspiring.
Now, I want to say something about Reverend Al. When he came out and he was talking, and, you know, he's a wonderful speaker, there's no doubt about that. And he was looking over there at me and saw me, and I was surprised that he said, there is a lady over there sitting there who started me on my radio and television career, all right? And he said, she's sitting right over there, looking right at me. And I started, you know, nodding my head. I said, yeah, you're right. Anyway, you have to say my name, but that's all right now.
And that is because, so people might not know why, that's because Reverend Al was a kind of a regular, semi-regular person who could call you up and talk about issues that were going on in the community when he was just becoming a community leader. Is that correct?
Yeah, sure. Waving him as that.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
it certainly was.
Case that we won't talk about, you know.
It was the Tawana Brawley case, being that it's a part of American history.
Yeah.
And the listeners who might not be familiar with that, which is what I'm trying to get you guys there, that were part of history to talk about. The Tawana Brawley case, as we know, to put it in historical context for people, was a pivotal case, certainly in the New York, New Jersey, Connecticut areas, and it also brought a lot of attention, very salacious case. But it also brought a lot of attention and put Reverend Al on the map, so to speak, because of his involvement with the case, which turned out to be somewhat negative, some would say, because of the way the case turned out. But that is the history that you guys have with Reverend Al and how he became or certainly on his journey to the person that he is today. Go ahead, Wayne.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, the thing is, Al was at the forefront of a number of cases, you know, way back then, you know, Howard Beach. People didn't particularly like his civil disobedience activity, but a lot of that, you know, stemmed from his, you know, activities in the New York area here. And at one time, you know, he was so much on everyone's program back in the day, people probably thought he was part of the payroll, which also worked against the company to a certain extent, because we always had to put this disclaimer out every once in a while that he wasn't, whenever people would come up to do newspaper articles. And I'm not talking about the Amsterdam News. I'm talking about, you know, the major dailies of that particular time, and that some still exist today. But it was just one of those things. But it was the Howard Beach case. It was Abner Louima. You know, Al capitalized on the success and the popularity of WLIB and the work of your mom and some of the other people.
You know, and he did.
I'm sorry.
He brought attention to those cases, and I'm glad that he was there. He brought attention to those
cases
that not a lot of people were talking about. So we covered them, you know. And
yeah.
They had merit, and he had merit. So I don't want to knock Al because of the fact that he really served a purpose. And of course, you know, some of the stuff was amusing, but because of maybe the way he looked, he was a little chubbier then, and, you know, that kind of thing. But he had something to say, and he brought attention to it. So I don't, you know, had a problem with him at all.
I think what
neither do I. I didn't mean to make it sound like as if I did, but I'm just saying that there were people outside of the black press who looked at him as if he were just a tool or an employee, and he would come on periodically, excuse me, and give his side as to what's going on. But Al has taken a bullet for a number of people, and I know, you know, regardless, no one likes to see a career end or a downside in one's abilities to stay on the air and stuff like that. But when I lost, you know, my high-profile position, I have to say that of all the people that I used to interact with on a regular basis in the political arena, it was the Reverend Al Sharpton who came to my defense and did things, you know, without asking for a dime, where, you know, there's some names I'd like to call, but I won't, who basically felt that, you know, it was a rite of passage that I contribute to whatever it is that they were doing. So, you know, it's crazy, but the bottom line is that he's gone through a metamorphosis of sorts in terms of his own physical appearance and changes. He's reinvented himself, but Al has always been consistent, you know, whether you agree with everything that he does or not. You know, Kay, you were there, you know, so we all, we could all say that we gave birth to him to a certain extent, and, you know, and I'm just happy that he's able to continue doing what he's doing, and that's it. Yeah.
And do you remember the story of David Hardy? You remember David Hardy with NBC and also with one of the newspapers, and how he was jerked around?
Yeah, right.
And that was the thing at the time, and yeah, I remember that because he did this story. And about Harrison Williams. That was the story about this politician in New Jersey. And I forgot exactly what the scene of it was.
Okay.
But David Hardy revealed certain things. And
that particular story.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was about Harrison Williams. Was it? He was a senator.
Yeah, it was.
Okay. Well.
That was the first one.
It was he did an in-depth story.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't want to start talking about details that might turn. Not actually be fat, but David Hardy, we know, was one of those really hard-hitting black reporters.
He was a journalist.
Getting back to Reverend Al, what was the interesting thing to me about Reverend Al at the time, and, you know, he fit a narrative, a dismissive narrative that the dominant culture tried to use to dismiss some black leaders, you know. And, you know, a lot of people, even a lot of black people, thought Reverend Al was kind of full of it when he came on the scene. But except for those in his particular neighborhood, in his particular environment, that knew that he was someone who could make some noise and get things done. And in that, in his kind of flamboyant personality,
so to speak, or just the way he looked really at the time. I don't think it was so much flamboyant other than, you know, he had the process and he was a big dude and wear the warm-up suits. But that got attention. Like my mom said, that got people's attention to the issues, and he was able to be loud enough and to be that character to bring attention to it. And by doing that, made him a target for the more dominant culture, but also helped serve our purpose. And our purpose was when he would come on black media, black radio, as he should have done to get to the community, as he is able to do now with MSNBC. You know, I don't watch him all the time because Reverend Al is still Reverend Al in his carriage, who he is. But you know, he does this. The black community. He's the black news, you know. Yeah. His show on MSNBC is the black people's news to a certain degree. And so when they try to attack people like that, and now Reverend Al, obviously his image now is much better, more refined than what it once was. But there's nothing wrong with that member of a group that brings attention to the issues and has to do what needs to be done. And we know how they like to dominate certain individuals in dominant culture, like to frame the narrative, frame the argument, so they can tell the story the way they want to tell the story, as opposed to what the story actually is.
And I'll say another thing, Wayne. You know, if Reverend Al Sharpton didn't exist, we'd have to invent him. Okay? I think his presence was necessary at that time, because we weren't going to be able to get the other major press, quote-unquote, you know, interested in that particular story about this young lady. Okay? So regardless of how it came out or anything like that, you know, when you get the press, and the white press, it was like white versus black at that particular time. It was a pain in the neck to read some of those stories. And so LIB had to exist. The LS had to exist. The AI had to exist. And I hope they still exist.
Right.
And, you know, but you know what, they want to do something, because you know we're going to be on for a number of.
We have another caller, and this might be our guest tonight. We're going to go to the caller and open the mic. Caller, hello. You're on the air with the Kay Thompson Live Show.
Hello, Kay Thompson Live Show. This is the caller.
Hi, caller. How are you? Want to say your name?
Sure. You want me to spell it?
What school did you go to?
My name is Cecilia Quarles. I'm an old friend of your family's and an old friend of Mr. Payne.
What's up, Cece Quarles? How are you?
Hi, Ms. Kay. It's Cecilia. Cece.
I know. Eric didn't know this. It was a secret that Lisa said, you know, she was going to do.
How are you doing, Cece Quarles?
I'm doing
old
really
Hampton
well.
Old roommate. Old Hampton schoolmate. That's a roommate. Uh-oh. Old Hampton schoolmate.
We might have roomed one or two times, you know, out of necessity.
Maybe.
Sounds very personal to me.
This is what, I'm part of our clique and one part of our crew that hung out with that school, Cece Quarles, one of the greatest people I know. And Cece, what are you doing these days? I forgot what you were doing okay, now they're writing notes to me. You were at the Prince concert in Baltimore, is that correct?
Yes, I was, and I actually moved back to Baltimore maybe about 4 or 5 years ago now. It's been to help my mother. She's 90, and it's ironically, you know, my mom lives probably 6 blocks away from where the riots were happening. So I saw the smoke, and I saw it myself, and a lot of emotion, and participated a little bit. Through some of the people that I knew that were participating as best I could. But it was very scary. Just very scary.
So is that now, I know that you're originally from Baltimore, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And let me ask you, on the ground there, is the situation with the police as bad as it is reported in terms of how they relate to the community?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, like any major city, Baltimore has a inner city, a street life that's been part of our culture forever. And, you know, just like any major city, the police are their own gang. And, you know, who knows, you know, what they have done, especially to, you know, the culture in the inner city that really don't have any voice. And what you saw in the riots was, you know, they were children. If you remember, they were kids. And these are children who are children of children, who are children of children, really, and who are children of pretty much drug addicts and people that have never had a chance at life. So they don't, if you don't know any better, you don't do any better. And it's sad because, like it has been said by some of our council people and senators, you know, Baltimore needs, like many other major cities, outlets for our babies to help them. There's nothing for them to do. And there hasn't been anything for them to do for generations. So this is nothing new. And when Freddie Gray was murdered, and he was murdered in plain sight on the street, as far as I'm concerned, you know, that was the straw that broke the camel's back. And, you know, kids have seen that, what we saw nationally on television over and over again without having any repercussions. They've seen their friends, you know, being killed. They were talking about it a lot in the interviews that were going on during the riots, you know, how their kids, you know, their friends aren't here anymore. Many of them have lost, you know, children and teenagers and young adults to police. You know, I had a gun drawn on me about 4 months ago, coming home from the movies. I was videotaping a friend of mine in the car. I had my tablet, and you know, my mother lives in a not too good area, and he saw us out there. The cop came, and I had a tablet in my hand, and I was filming on a tablet, and he got out the car and had a gun drawn. I said, "This is a tablet." And he told me to put it down. Living
now,
with
a black. Was this an officer of color? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but I was just
curious.
No,
was a white police officer. He was white.
Okay. Yeah.
He was white, so, and he had no problem just pulling a gun on me on sight without talking, without asking any questions, without any. And it was a tablet I had made. There's no way. I mean, it looks like a tablet. You know,
resembles a gun. Yeah, exactly.
Everybody knows what that looks like. Now, let me ask you.
And I look like a school teacher. I don't look, I look like a school teacher. I was coming from the movies, you know, on a date. I was cute. I mean, and they pulled a gun on me. So I can't imagine what our black brothers and our black babies go through on a daily basis. It's too much.
Who makes up the majority of the police force? Because if I'm, you know, talking to my friends in Baltimore and this, the short period of time that I spent there doing a show, but, you know, we went to school together. Cece and I have a partner, business partner that's from Baltimore as well, when I have my film company. Is it people move out to PG County? I heard people talk about PG County. Is that outside the city of Baltimore, and is that where a lot of the white folks reside, where you have people coming into the city from out, you know, the suburbs
Well, PG County is more of a D.C. suburb. PG County is more of a D.C. suburb, and really it's become Latin. You know, Washington has become so gentrified. I don't, you know, if you go to D.C. and you're like, where are the black people? I don't know where they are.
Is that right? Wow.
Oh, my, if they're gone. It's unbelievable.
At one time, Prince George's County was considered the largest concentration of affluent blacks in this country.
And
you know,
I think you're absolutely
correct.
Still has
that reputation.
But it's also there's an influx of Latinos in PG County, parts of it as well. But back in the 70s and the 80s, that's exactly what PG County was, and it's very different now.
Wow.
Now, where is that area? Because I thought there was an area outside of Baltimore that was, you know, the more racially polarized area or the more racist area, I'll just say it, that was not the best for blacks to go through. Is there an area like that?
Oh, and, sure. I mean, there. You know, Baltimore has several counties. Baltimore is just not inner city. It's several counties. I mean, downtown, like Fells Point, is pretty much, you know, it's still city, but there's not many black people there. Towson, Pikesville, you know, those areas are more Jewish concentrated and not as many blacks in Towson. You know, those are the major kind of counties that are surround the city. Roland Park, you know, there are still ordinances in Roland Park back from the 50s and the 40s that won't allow the homeowners to sell to black people. And I think some of those, and I think some of those still exist. Those are where the really big houses are, you know, which
so
is not, and Roland Park is probably 15 minutes outside the city.
So where do these, where would there's a cop like that who pulled the gun on your white guy, where does he come from? Is that someone who lives outside of the inner city of Baltimore and comes, makes the commute in?
He looked like a Marine. I don't even think he was probably from Baltimore. He looked like he was just waiting. He just looked like he wanted to shoot somebody to me. And I my first thought was, I'm going to be killed in front of my mother's house. I mean, I was just, it was unbelievable. And he really didn't back down for a minute. He did not back down. I said, I'm holding a tablet. What are you doing out here? I mean, he was screaming at me. It was unbelievable. I mean, so, again, I cannot even imagine what, you know, the inner city youth and the blacks in this city have gone through, you know, on a daily basis. And it's like you saw, that was the straw that broke the camel's back. And I'm really proud of my city. I'm really proud of what happened, even though they destroyed. It's interesting. I'm not going to say I'm proud of that, but, you know, I understand it. But it's interesting that everything they destroyed, that CVS that you all saw burning, is directly across the street from the public library, and they didn't touch it. And the front of it is all glass, and they didn't touch that at all. And people don't talk about that.
Exactly. Don't hear anything about that.
They didn't hear anything. Right. All those riots and police were standing. They were standing in front of right across the street was the public library that's been there forever.
And I'm trying to understand the, you know, your assessment with respect to that, you know, the public library. I mean, I know it's a place of learning and it's an institution, but I mean, why not? Why would that be exempt from, you know?
Most of the people that go there are black. The people that work there are black, and even though the people that work there work at CVS are black too, it's not a black owned business. And neither is the check cashing place, and neither is any of the businesses, you know, that they destroyed. None of them. They didn't destroy any black-owned business. The few that are in that area were not destroyed or touched in any way.
Right. Is there a home residency requirement on the part of the police there? I mean, in municipal jobs, period, is that something required of people living in Baltimore to work in, you know, as a cop or a fireman?
You know, I'm not sure. I really don't know. I'm not sure. I'm not sure about that. I know the mayor and the government officials in City Hall have to live in the city. But I'm not sure about Baltimore City police officers, if they do or not. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, another thing that was addressed, too, is that, you know, so many of the police officers are, you know, there are many black police officers. And that's part of the problem as well, that, you know, not all police officers are bad, obviously. But the good ones don't speak up. They condone it by not saying anything, and the good ones that know what's going on and know these bad cops are out there, let it go and don't say anything. So that's a problem too. That's a problem too.
What's your assessment of the job that the mayor did first off, and her initial reflex comments about calling the kids thugs and things like that, and what's your overall assessment about the job she's done the flack about that comment and any and the overall perspective.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I think she's. I didn't like that when she said thugs. It sent a shiver down my spine because I felt it showed such a lack of empathy for a city that she's from and she supposedly understands. You know, it was so wrong what the kids did. Yeah, but I mean, again, people are fed up and people got emotional. And some of the kids are out there just, you know, going crazy for no reason. But it's a deep rooted issue, and they were just expressing themselves in a lot of ways. I wish that I think the mayor got overwhelmed in a way. I think that she got completely overwhelmed and had to say something. And her first speech that she said, you know, when she said, I'm lost for words, and I felt like, how can you be lost for words when the nation is listening to you right now? I think, yeah, she got overwhelmed. I'm hoping that, you know, as this thing progresses, because it's so far from being over, that she gets herself together and becomes more of a leader and a representer of, you know, everybody in this city, as opposed to her constituencies and trying to be speaking politically correctly, which I think is what she did.
You know, that's how I feel about the demonstrations. There were things waiting to happen, okay, because of the lesson of the way that different police departments, different people in the police departments, not them all, naturally, but there's a group of real serious racists who would really shoot people and then, you know, get away with it because they know they can. And this kind of thing has been going on for I don't know how long. It was something that was bound to happen and bound to happen again. Let me ask you this. The Prince concert. I admire going in there and trying to do something. And what was the result of that? Did that help anything at all? It was a good thing that he came in. But,
Ms. Kay, yes. You know what? And I just commend him. I can imagine him being in wherever he lives and looking at our city going through what happened, like everybody else in the nation. And he decided to do something. And oh my goodness, I cannot. I can't commend him. Prince doesn't have to lift a finger for the rest of his life. And he gave the place was completely sold out. Everybody there was in good spirits. It was a reunion, you know, people you hadn't seen. And he played music for 2.5 hours straight. He had Marilyn Mosby and her husband on stage with him, and Freddie Gray's family was on stage with him. He really reached out, and then he talked to the audience, and he let us know that he was with us and he was with our struggle, and he said, you know, what we need now is peace, P-I-E-C-E. And he said the next time he comes to Baltimore, you know, he wants to stay at a hotel. He empowered the young people. He said, I want to stay at a hotel that you own. You know, I want a car service to come pick me up that you own. You know, it's time for us to work towards, you know, empowering ourselves so that we can have ownership in our own future. And, you know, everybody was for him, and everybody it was wonderful. It was really, really wonderful. I wish that, you know, more celebrities would take a stand and do what he did, because it helps so much more than words can really say. It was wonderful.
Well, maybe we can sort of encourage them. If you want to speak, you know, on a show and support Baltimore, I have relatives in Baltimore, and I'm going to be getting in touch with them because I want to see. We want to report on it. We're in the New Jersey, New York area. We want to let people know what's happening around the country. This does not have to happen. And
exactly.
You know, just demonstrate peacefully, if that's what's called for.
Yes.
These kids are going to lose. But also, they're going to lose, and they might as well go down fighting or something like that. That's so unnecessary. And, you know, look, it's not that these police, it's not that you're not paying their salaries. You know what I'm talking about?
You know,
yes.
I just wanted to say.
Yes, exactly.
I think it's Billy Murphy there, the Gray family attorney.
Yes.
Really, I was watching on NBC, MSNBC, and he broke it down really about, he gave a history lesson. And I first got hip to him watching The Wire, on the episode of The Wire that he was on, and I kind of knew he was a real guy within the city just by the reverence he had in the scene. But what he said was actually true. He said, you know, the police department, police enforce the law. And if you remember in our history of America, that at one time it was pretty much illegal to be black or illegal to be a free black person in this society. The police would be the ones who would enforce that law. If a black person was walking around unaccompanied, a slave at the time, was walking around by themselves or seemed to be run away, the police were the ones that went and got them and put them back. Yes, slave catchers, but the police were the ones that made sure those laws were kept in order. They're the ones that enforced those laws, that enslaved black people, that treated us like Jim Crow, treated us like second-class citizens. So the evolution of the police force is one that kind of was put in place to control that black population for centuries. So now we come out of that and the history of our country, their role has been one of suppression a lot of times, particularly amongst the masses and hordes of black people. So it's no wonder now that we find ourselves at this position where they're still doing what they were supposed to do, what their job was initially supposed to do. And as my mother said, you know, and talking about the police officer that you talked about, yeah, some of them do join the police department to kill black people, I believe, in some of these areas.
Yeah.
It's wrong that the kids get frustrated and angry, but, you know, Malcolm X said, you know, the chickens come home to roost when you live in an environment of violence and you condone violence around
the
world. Absolutely. Eventually that violence is going to come back to you.
That's what you saw. And the irony, too, is Eric, is that if we didn't have cell phones, the guy in South Carolina that was running away and got shot in the back, I can't remember his name, I'm sorry. Walter Scott and Freddie Gray. And who else knows? Other cases would have all gotten away with it.
Exactly.
Well, social media certainly played a role, I mean, to basically amplify and give light to things that have been going on for so long, you know. So,
yeah.
I mean, the deal is there's something to be said of that. But at the same time, you know, I mean, I recognize and I can understand why there's been this you know, resonation of disgust in our community. But at the same time, you know, there's got to be some meaningful way to bring some sort of modification in the part of changing the police culture. And it's not just something that's just relegated to white folks in the force.
I've seen
blacks treat black folks just as despicably as I've seen whites do it. And they think it's like a badge of honor because they beat up on their own. You know?
What I have seen I'm sorry to cut you off. Go ahead.
No, that's all right. Go ahead.
What I have seen in respect to what you're saying lately and what they're trying to enforce now is back to police officers walking in neighborhoods and knowing, you know, the neighborhood, knowing the people that lived on the street, like it used to be when we were in elementary school, officer friendly, you know, and so they are starting, and I've seen this yesterday, as a matter of fact, police officers walking with their uniforms on the street. I think that we have got to start squashing and squelching this fear that our community has on sight of police officers. You know, Freddie Gray just looked at those police officers and decided to run because he's afraid of them. He didn't do anything. That's what happened.
Yeah,
I'm afraid to drive around them.
I mean, you're right. That's exactly what we need to do. We also need to change their culture and change our culture, where black people don't assume, some of us, not all, don't assume the role of, I don't want to say suspect, but don't assume that you're doing something wrong, that you want to avoid going to where there's a lot of cops. I'll give you an example of what I mean. I was in L.A. When I was living in L.A., a friend of mine, we were going out,
and he lived in the portion of L.A. Leicester Valley. He'd drive into Hollywood to hang out. He didn't want to drive into Hollywood for a number of reasons, but one of the reasons was there's just too many cops there, this and that. And just that aspect of not wanting to go someplace because you might get pulled over, to me, never was something that was ingrained in me. I think in some of us that maybe have been as fortunate enough to grow up as blessed or receiving the benefits that some of us, the mass of the black people didn't, we've kind of fallen into that thing of being wary of the cops, of not remembering those. I paid their salaries.
Yeah.
And not to walk around with that arrogance, but to talk to them as an individual, as a taxpayer, not as a you feel like a suspect or feel like best like a second class citizen. But when I'm addressed by a police officer, I look him in the eye. I don't disrespect him, but I talk with him with the authority of, yeah, I'm a free citizen. I'm not a criminal. You know, sometimes you get pulled over and want to ask you. I remember a cop asked me, are you on parole? Are you this and that? I'm like, no, man, I'm not a criminal. I don't know what you're talking about. Because I don't do those type of things. So I'm not worried about you pulling me over.
Yeah.
Yes, my stuff is in order. Of course it is. And you want to tell me why you're pulling me over now? You know, so
well, you had a broken taillight. You know, that's the story. You had a broken taillight that doesn't exist.
You're right. And then you think of that with that perspective, I'm not talking about being disrespectful, but, you know, we need to, as well as we break the culture of police officers, and I think it's about training, and I think it's about promoting the good one and the ones who are going to step forward and really want to keep the peace and bring the order and protect and serve, protect the good people, get the bad people. And let's make these things on the paper that's on black and white paper, let's cause all of us to live up to those efforts, you know? If we're talking about you're going to be the police officer and you're there to protect and serve, let's make you live up to that. It's just in the Declaration of Independence or whatever, all those guys were slave owners, even though they wrote all men are created equal. And I think that maybe the nature of man is to try to be a better man and woman, humans, to try to be better above and rise to the occasion, not always be the base in ourselves. So we have to demand that these words are adhered to. Not are adhered to if you're white, not are adhered to if you're rich, but these words are adhered to. And that's what we need to demand. We're coming up on talking a little bit long, but we're coming up on. We have a minute left, just about 90 seconds left.
Thank you. Okay.
Cece, thank you for calling.
Yeah. Ms. K, thank you. It's an honor and a pleasure, always. And Eric, let's keep better in touch, you guys. Thank you for what you're doing.
We're going to talk to you again about calling in.
Yeah, about Baltimore.
And I'm so sorry that you went. I'm sorry that you went there. You hang in there. You know, we're going to be in your corner.
Thank you very much. I very appreciate it. God bless you all.
Thank you.
Good night.
Okay.
Good talking to you. Wayne
Gilman.
Thank
you, guys.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Wayne.
Yes. it was a great hour. I mean, very informative, and it's good to talk to someone who was right there to see what was going on, you know. Sounds like a nice person.
Absolutely. She is 100%. She's a Hampton woman, so there you go. That's even all the more, baby.
Oh, really? And, is she single?
I don't know about that, Wayne, but
I had my chance to ask. I didn't want to embarrass myself.
And Wayne Gilmore, thank you once again. This has been the Kay Thompson Live Show. You can catch us every Wednesday evening live from 8 to 9 p.m. on the Blog Talk Radio /Kay Thompson Live, or the show can also be archived, meaning you can listen to it at any time you want. So just go to the website. I am the son. My name is Eric Payne. You are?
And I'm the mother.
All right. Have a good night.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you, Wayne. Thank you, everybody. Good night. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Wayne.